Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We start the show today by taking a look at life along the Mississippi River. Back with us, Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And the March-April issue is just coming out now. You might have it maybe in your mailbox, maybe not, but it'll be there soon. And as usual, the magazine includes lots of articles about conservation, wildlife, and history of the Upper Mississippi River. As I talk with Reggie, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about this really significant area? What impresses you about it? Maybe you visited it. Maybe you live there. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Reggie, welcome. I might have misspoken there. Is the issue still at the printers?
Good morning, Larry. It's going to the post office probably tomorrow.
Okay.
If there's still a post office there, but yeah.
Okay.
That's the plan anyway. Should get it by the end of the week.
Yeah. Well, I've had a chance to look at it online, and it's a dandy issue again.
Thank you.
Remind us, for those who aren't familiar with it, what's the focus primarily of the magazine?
Well, we're a regional magazine, and we cover the Driftless area and the Mississippi River, the section of it that goes through the Driftless area. So we cover from the Twin Cities down to the Quad Cities and go over from about Madison, Wisconsin, over around Rochester, Minnesota, Decorah, Iowa. So it's that whole Driftless area, but the focus is on the river, and most of the people live along the river in the Driftless area, too. So
Yeah. Makes sense. In your opening column in this new issue, you talk about a collection of old maps and photos from the Upper Mississippi River Wildlife and Fish Refuge, and they're now held at UW-La Crosse. How did these artifacts find their way to UW-La Crosse? That's an interesting story.
Yeah, it was kind of fun to get a chance to tell that story because it was back, around 20 years ago, they closed the sign shop. The sign shop for all the national refuges was in Winona, and they were going to shut it down, and they were cleaning out the building, and a guy who worked for the Upper Mississippi River Fish and Wildlife Refuge went over there to see how they were doing and talked to the guys. And he looked in a dumpster, and there were all of these maps and photos. Many of the maps were from the late 1800s. And they were incredible maps. They had, some of them had been used by pilots, so they had notes on them for navigation and landmarks. And the map showed the river, of course, as it was before the lock and dam system was put in. And it was entirely different. This stretch of the river was really entirely different before the locks and dams were put in the 1930s. And these maps, actually, some of the maps actually identified groups of trees on the river bottom forests. They'd say elms, you know, or swamp oaks or things like that. So they're really precious resources, and there probably aren't too many of those old maps left around. They're on real flimsy paper, kind of delicate things, especially since they're, you know, almost 150 years old. So those are over at the library now at UW-La Crosse, and they're going to start scanning them in. They're trying to raise the funds to get a new scanner that can do a good job of that, and they'll put them on the web, so people will be able to just look at them for free and share them around, which is incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, that Murphy Library at UW-La Crosse, you have some more information on it in the magazine, bringing together something called the Driftless River Initiative, which I found really fascinating, too. Describe that.
Yeah, well, that's that really overlaps a lot with what we're doing, so we're really going to make our job a little easier. The special collections at the Murphy Library probably started about 30 years ago, and they've been trying to collect a lot of regional resources and publications and government reports and so on and provide them to the public. And this new initiative, the Driftless Initiative, is going to have more focus on the Driftless area and identifying and cataloging and making available just a lot of wonderful things about the area that, like I said, some of those pieces go back to the late 1800s. And a lot of the steamboat, riverboat photos that you see in our publication and other publications are from the Murphy Library. They actually were given what is probably the largest collection of steamboat, riverboat photos in the world. A guy named Ralph DuPay, who was a salesman, when he'd travel around the country, he'd seek out these old photographs and buy them or copy them and then give them to the library. He gave them thousands of steamboat photographs. And then, because the way that works, other people that had similar collections also gave those to the library. So that was kind of how the focus on the river started. That really got things rolling.
It's really cool. I remember somebody donated a collections that included river music and movies and shift menus, a whole bunch of really interesting things.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's multimedia, and they have recordings. I remember back when I was a reporter, back in the 80s, I think, there were some students at UW La Crosse that were going around interviewing old-timers about what the river was like early in the 20th century. And those recordings, you can listen to those recordings there, and a lot of them have been transcribed, so you can even get the printouts of the recordings of these people remembering things. So it's incredible that they captured those resources when they could and that they're saving them and sharing them.
It really, really is. Looking at some other stories, one that I really enjoyed, Trolling in Clinton, I think, was the title. A guy, Thomas Dambo.
Yeah.
And that photo you've got in there is tremendous, by the way.
Yeah. That's one big troll. they're kind of art installations that this this guy, where is he based? Is he based in Sweden? I'm looking at it right now.
I think it's Sweden, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. And he's contracting to build some of these installations of trolls made out of recycled materials in Clinton over next year in 2026. And this photo shows this troll made out of recycled lumber, it appears. And I would say if that guy stood up straight, he'd be about 60 feet tall, Larry?
Yeah.
But he's reclining, leaning up against a tree with the young man standing on his chest. it is a very cool photo.
It is a very, and of course, the Clinton, is they're kind of thinking about that as a way to draw some visitors.
Yeah, and I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. And you know, that's an interesting thing with river cities is there's been a lot of art installations and murals, and this is going to be a spectacular one. They have a really good sawmill museum down there, too, that's near the river. Clinton, a lot of river towns back in the late 1800s and early 20th centuries, their shoreline was lined with sawmills, and that's where they cut up all the north woods, floated it down the river, and then made it into lumber, and that's what built a lot of the houses, not only in the river towns, but even way out west. You know, the trains were taking it out west to build towns.
Yeah, it's pretty darn cool. Well, I have to mention Pearl or Aura McGill. Now, that was a really fascinating story to me. This is Pearl, well, that was her nickname. Pearl McGill was murdered in 1924.
Yeah. And no one, I don't think anyone was ever, her husband was charged.
But he wound up dead.
He wound up dead. And they don't know, maybe he was murdered or maybe it was suicide. I mean, it's one of those mysteries that probably won't ever be solved. But she had become a union organizer. She was originally hired to work in a button mill. And then specifically downstream at Muscatine, Iowa, that was kind of the pro-button capital of the world for a while. And they would harvest freshwater mussels from the river and make buttons out of the shells. And they were, you know, if you, the plastic button that's probably on your shirt, if you look at it, it either looks like a piece of horn or a mussel shell. You know, it's kind of mother of pearl.
Yeah.
And they're all plastic now, but that back then they really made them out of horn and mussel shells. And she worked at a factory there in Muscatine and kind of got hired because her uncle was in the business. And she was really hired to spy on her coworkers to make sure they didn't organize unions or go on strike and stuff. And she, after working there for a while, she realized maybe they needed unions and maybe they needed to be empowered. And then she kind of switched sides and became a union organizer. And she was murdered, as were several other union organizers around that time in the 1920s.
It's a fascinating story. And just the side story, or the, I don't know if it's a side story, but the whole information on the pearl, the button industry at that time, I mean, that was big business. There were places all along the river there making buttons.
Yeah, and I have been in construction sites and by railroad tracks and stuff and found mussel shells, and you can still find these sometimes, with perfect holes drilled in them about, you know, anywhere from a half inch to maybe 3/4 inch. And that was the waste from making the pearl buttons. They used it for fill in construction sites, and some of the alleys in Muscatine were full of those shells with holes drilled in them. It was a big deal. And the Pearl Button Museum in Muscatine, is, if you want to learn about it, that's a fantastic museum. I've been there a number of times, and it's overwhelming almost.
Well, it is, and you've got some nice photos in this magazine not only of Pearl and some of the other women who worked at that time, but then again, the museum itself.
Yeah.
Which is pretty darn cool. Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, our guest today. You can join in with your own questions, comments, or maybe you've got a remembrance to share. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Taking a look at life along the Mississippi today with Reggie McLeod. He's editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Always great to have him stop by and talk with us. And you can join in. Number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to James in Baraboo. James, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you. I have my great-grandfather's license to pilot steam vessels on the Mississippi. It's one of my most treasured possessions. He was a lawyer and a judge in La Crosse, and he had a pleasure boat that was steam-powered, and this is in about 1912 or even earlier. Let's see, the date on here is 1912, yes. So the license allows him to navigate between Wabasha, Minnesota, and McGregor, Iowa.
That's very nice, yeah.
Yeah, very, very, very cool. I wonder if you had to go through any testing for that, Reggie, for to get a license like that, or if you just had to be somebody with a steamboat.
Well, up until fairly recently, people that were getting a license had to actually draw the stretch of river that they were licensed for. And they could, you know, they could use a map. They didn't sit there and draw it in an hour or anything. But the towboat pilots, and this is, I don't know how, when they changed it, because everything is digital now, you know, they have digital maps. But up until probably about 10 years ago, I think, they'd have to draw the entire navigable part of the river, which is, I should know that exactly, but it's probably around at least 1,500 miles of river. And
So you had to demonstrate you knew what you where the good spots were to be navigating.
Oh yeah, and they know the names of the islands and the landmarks, you know, things that they line up for when they go under a bridge. I mean, there's just thousands of details for doing that kind of work.
Yeah.
And even Wabasha down to McGregor, I mean, there's a lot going. That's a part that I'm most familiar with that I've paddled and all of that. And there's a lot going on there and a lot of islands and channels and everything. And it was changing more back then before the locks and dams. Things could shift around a little bit easier.
Yeah. James, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Tom in Minocqua. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Good morning, Larry. I'm a Catholic priest. About 30 years ago, I was assigned to a parish in La Crosse, but I was sent to fill in at St. Lawrence, the Catholic Church in Alma. And it was in the afternoon on Christmas Eve. I was running a little late, worried about other things. So I get there, we process in, begin Mass, and I look out to my right, and there is the Mississippi River flowing by. I just kind of took my breath away and have this wonderful, you know, force of nature right out visible from the windows of the church. And I think the windows are clear so you can look out and see the river as it flows by. So that's just one story. What I wanted to ask about is what your guest thinks about the impact of riverboats on the Mississippi, how that's just affecting life. And I kind of find it intriguing, but I also kind of find it to be disruptive to what you see as you're spending time along the river. It might be worth a show, Larry, to talk about riverboats on the Mississippi and the Great Lakes someday.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you talking about the passenger riverboats or the barges and towboats?
Yeah, I'm sorry, yes, the cruise ships.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Tom.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's really changed a lot in the last 10 years or so, especially, and it's still changing. There were three companies on the, you know, with riverboats, long distance cruises overnight, you know, where people stay overnight on the boats. And one of them went out of business. I think it was the Mississippi Queen, no, American Queen. And now it's the American Cruise Lines is still going strong, and they've been cranking out a new boat every year, pretty much, I think. And then Viking Lines just started a couple years ago. I kind of like it. They're not particularly disruptive. Quite a few of our riders now actually work as river lorians on the boats, and that's kind of interesting. And we've known a few people who were captains and pilots on the boats, so we often go on the boats when they stop in town here and hang out a little bit. I think it's good. I think the river lorians do a good job. Usually they're people that have pretty broad knowledge of the river. In fact, the ones I know that have been doing it grew up on the river and spent a lot of time in their youth on the river. Or one friend is a pilot who was a pilot on the biggest towboat on the river for a while, the Army Corps boat. I think it's good for them to learn about the river and to visit the river towns, and they learn about river issues too when they're on the boats, as well as the history and entertainment. And people come from all over the country and all over the world to travel on those boats. So I think it's a good thing. I haven't seen anything that I would consider bad about it offhand. And those boats are pretty well managed and everything. They have to get fresh water and get the trash off it, and they have pretty strict protocols and everything. They're pretty cool. I've never traveled on one. They're pretty expensive. They can cost usually around $1,000 a day, or maybe $700 to $1,000 a day. But they take good care of you. The food's good. I've eaten on them a few times. I certainly endorse the quality of the food on there. I think I'd gain a few pounds if I went on a long cruise.
Tom, thank you so much for that remembrance and also for your question. Appreciate it very much. You can join in with your own thoughts. Maybe you have an experience to share, or maybe you just have a question. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. We had a story in the magazine about the Rapidan Dam that failed, I think it was last June. And, okay, it was in Minnesota, but it has, and of course we have Minnesota listeners, so that's fine, but there are also some effects of that dam failing that have an impact on the Mississippi.
Yes, and I really like saying Rapidan Dam, so yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. But it released 11 million cubic yards of silt into the Blue Earth River, which flows into the Minnesota River, which flows into the Mississippi River at the Twin Cities. And this is really an awful lot of silt. It's a huge volume. And people, I was hoping to find out more about when it was going to get to the Mississippi. They're particularly nervous about it on Lake Pepin,
yeah,
which of course is half in Minnesota and half in Wisconsin, because it's a wide lake with very little current. So if the silt will get down, some of it will get down that far, and it's going to settle in the lake because where the current is so slow. And the Army Corps of Engineers is currently doing, I know I shouldn't have used that word. The Army Corps of Engineers recently started a big project on the upper end of Lake Pepin by Bay City, and they're restoring the river because it's silting in very quickly, much more quickly than it would naturally, mostly because of silt coming down the Minnesota River anyway before this dam collapsed. There's so much silt coming down there, largely because of agricultural drainage on the watershed. And so they're spending millions and millions of dollars to kind of dredge it out and clean it out and restore some islands and channels. And it's kind of an environmental project as well as one that's going to benefit transportation. And so that silt could potentially come down there and kind of undo the work that they're doing, and it could actually make it hard to navigate the river for towboats and the big passenger boats too once that gets to the Mississippi. But the frustrating thing about working on this story is no one really knows how much of it or when it's going to get to the Mississippi River, and that's partly because the climate change has made it so, you don't know if we're going to have a drought this spring and summer or if we're going to have floods this spring and summer. I mean, the extremes are so much broader than they used to be that everyone's just kind of keeping their fingers crossed and watching it. So it's a big deal. And I think it's already causing some big problems on the Minnesota River. There is some barge traffic on the Minnesota River that's been affected by it. And the Army Corps has had to do a lot more dredging in the Minnesota River than they would normally do because of that dam breaking.
Yeah, pretty pretty dramatic photo in your magazine, too, of the dam itself and where it kind of started to break up. It was a big earthen dam.
Yeah, well, there was, no, it was, I think it was a concrete dam, but it, when it started to break the dam, it kind of circumvented, it went around the side,
yeah,
and dug into the earth. There's a bluff there, and it actually swept away a store and a home. I mean, it took a lot of soil out of the bluff on that side of the dam too. So, so the dam collapsed, and the soil was collapsing, and it was a mess. And again, that was largely because of climate change. You know, they had so much rain in that watershed on the Blue Earth that it wiped out the dam. And a lot, you know, pretty much all the dams that were built before about 2000 are out of spec because the specs have changed because the climate has changed. So they build them assuming that the maximum rainfall will be, you know, a certain amount at a certain rate. And that's not true anymore because we've exceeded those specs.
Yeah.
So they're all a little bit vulnerable because of that.
You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I was interested in a little piece you had on what researchers at University of Minnesota and in Korea developing some technology that could identify plastic debris at the bottom of freshwater rivers and lakes. There's some potential there.
Yeah, there were a couple stories that kind of overlapped there. And one is being able to identify plastic waste in the water and differentiate it from, you know, natural waste like, you know, leaves or stems or rocks and that kind of thing. And the other one is building sort of a robot device that will be able to cruise around in the water and remove the plastic from it. It seems to me it would be much more efficient not to put the damn plastic in there to begin with. But if it's a problem in a lot of places already, and this would certainly help with remediation, you know, efforts to clean it up. So it's pretty cool. I mean, we're going to see robots doing a lot more things, I think, in the near future.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was a fascinating little story. Bob in Superior has a question. Let's go there. Bob, hello.
Hello again. I guess I call every other year. what I want to know is, well, to start with, I was sitting on the riverbank in St. Louis one time, looking across the river to East St. Louis, and pretty much everybody that walked by, I said, how deep is the river here? And actually, nobody had the faintest idea. And I asked a couple other people, it's like, well, what's the minimum depth to operate these tugboats and barges? And one person told me it was 4.5 feet. And I'm not buying that. I bet you they've got 7-foot props. But once again, I've never seen one out of the water either.
Yeah, so what's the navigable depth of the river for those tugs?
Okay, the legal depth is above St. Louis because the last lock and dam, and the locks and dams were built to maintain the channel at least 9 feet deep. So it's a 9-foot channel. So the last lock and dam is just above St. Louis there, and everything from St. Louis all the way up to St. Paul, the Army Corps has to maintain a 9-foot channel, and they have to dredge it to 9 feet. And the dams were placed. They did a huge survey of the river in the late 1920s, and, you know, they surveyed the bottom of the river, cross-sections, like thousands of cross-sections. And so they calculated where to place the dams so that they would hold enough water behind them to get over the shallowest spots in the river. See, that was the strategy. They just didn't build them every 30 miles. They built them below the shallow spots. And so that's the deal, is 9 foot. There was talk occasionally on doing a 12-foot channel, and I don't think that'll ever happen. It gets harder and harder for them to maintain the 9-foot channel because, again, climate change, but also the backwaters have filled in with silt in a lot of places. And, you know, that whole river where there used to be islands, there used to be lakes in the backwaters, even up here around La Crosse and Winona, that were 30 or 40 feet deep, and there isn't any more. Some of the lakes and channels have pretty much disappeared because so much silt has settled in there because of the dams, you know, holding it back and slowing down the river as it moves down there. So, yeah, the 9-foot channel. It started doing a 4.5-foot channel was the first channel that the Corps had to maintain. That's in the old river boats used to only have about a 3 or 4 foot draft. But now they can go up to 9 feet. And some of those tour boats are, I think, around 8 feet, 8.5 feet, I believe.
Okay. Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And I think Lynn and Sister Bay may have a question that kind of relates. Lynn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hi, Larry.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm curious as to the impact of the quality of the water and soil erosion on the banks of these bigger ships that are going down the river.
Yeah, so the impact of the big ships on the river, studies of their impact in terms of, you know, erosion and that sort of thing, Reggie.
All the boats cause some erosion. I think, you know, there's riprap in a lot of places, and the part of the erosion is exacerbated a little bit, well, no, a lot in some places, because the river level used to drop in the summer, and so there was a lot more plant life in the river and a lot more plants on the shoreline that would kind of absorb some of the energy of wakes and waves and that sort of thing. And those are not there anymore because they maintain the river level at a more constant, you know, level. So that's part of it. And I think the smaller boats often cause a more damaging wake because when I've been and I've paddled a lot on the river and I've had a small houseboat and motorboats too, the wake from a cruiser that's going really fast is more destructive than the wake of a towboat. The towboats and the big passenger boats have more of a swell, you know, so the water level kind of rises and falls, and you don't have as much of a wake. It seems like the fast kind of wake that slaps up against the shore. They all have an effect on the shoreline, though, and like I said, the lack of plants makes it more damaging. Some of the plants are starting to come back, though, and some of the Army Corps projects that have restored the river, like what they're doing up in the upper Lake Pepin area, they put in riprap and they make areas where the plants grow well, and that helps a lot, but that only affects a tiny percentage of the total river.
Yeah. Lynn, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Hazel in Hayward, we'll go to you now. Hi, Hazel.
Hi. I have two questions. My great-grandmother, Grund, who was Swedish, during the Civil War used to gather. We always thought it was clams to make buttons from to make money, but would it have really been mollusks? And then the other question is, what about the mounds, like effigy mounds and regular mounds from long ago? I presume they're all protected now, but what have been the destruction or any way of now protecting things that didn't used to be protected? So I'll just hang up and hear your answers.
All right. Thanks for calling. A couple of questions for you there.
They're both big questions. Well, the button one is easier because the mollusks, which is kind of a broad term. Mollusks includes, you know, I think even snails and octopuses. Yeah. But the clam shells in the river really are mussel shells. There's only a couple types of small clams that actually live in the river. And they're, I think a fingernail clam is one. I'm not sure about the others, but they were technically mussel shells that they harvested, the big ones. And in fact, speaking of ancient sites, there are places on the islands where there are big piles of mussel shells, and I used to think that was an anomaly of the current that would, you know, kind of push them there. But actually, the Indians that lived on the river would, they were a big food source, and they were like trash piles of mussels that they had eaten. They tossed the shells on there. So, and regarding the Indian mounds, if they're on private land, you can do whatever you want with them. You could bulldoze them and so on. But I think people now are sensitive enough where they, most people that have them on their land kind of take good care of them. Not always, and that can be an issue with construction projects sometimes. If they're on federal land, they're protected. Generally, if they're on state land, I'm not sure what all the state regulations are. I know Minnesota and Wisconsin protect burial sites, ancient burial sites, if they're on public land. But then also, if federal funds are paying part of a project, they have to, you know, that's moving the earth around, they also have to contract to have an archaeologist at the site to make sure they don't destroy any mounds or any archaeological sites. So if it's a county, they probably don't. And the states might regulate it that way too. If it's a construction site, I don't know if they require them to have an archaeologist, but if it came to light that there was an archaeological site there, they'd probably protect it. But on private land, people can do whatever they want. A lot of those mounds have already been dug up. It was kind of a thing in the late 1800s and early 20th century to go have a picnic and dig up an Indian mound and throw the bones around and see if you could find some arrowheads. And fortunately, we don't do that anymore. Yeah. I hope.
I hope so too. Reggie McLeod, our guest editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Da, da, da.
Bum, 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 a happy bum, birthday, bum, a great big to-do. Bum, 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 let's celebrate, yeah, celebrate you. So make a wish on your special day. You're looking great,
so great,
come celebrate. Happy birthday from us to you.
Oh, from the place,
yes, from the place where dreams do come true. So here's a wish, 1, 2, 3, 4, part harmony. Happy birthday, your special day
to you.
Yes, to you.
Well,
happy
Larry,
birthday, Reggie.
Larry, Joel, and Jeff, you guys have been practicing, obviously. I'm very impressed.
Well,
it's
your birthday today, and you were gracious enough to spend part of your day with us. So happy birthday to you. And frankly, happy birthday to anybody else listening. It's today's your birthday. Happy birthday. Consider that a song for you as well as for Reggie McLeod. That was great. Reggie, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. I was an old barbershopper myself.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I really liked Jill's selection there of the happy birthday song, for sure.
Well, yeah, I don't think I've heard that one before.
Oh, man. Let's take some calls. If you want to join in, the number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Paul in Baraboo, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. Paul Walter with the Sauk County Historical Society, and we're the proud owners of the Man Mound National Historic Landmark. And I just wanted to clarify that all Indian mounds, whether they're conical, effigy, linear, are all protected by Wisconsin's burial sites law. So whether they're on private property or public property, they cannot be touched or destroyed.
That is very good news to have, Paul. Thank you for calling. And Reggie, nice to have that here in Wisconsin. It's possible other states might not have that designation.
Yeah, I think so. And thanks for clarifying that. I was under the impression that on private land they could mess with them. But yeah, that's good that they're not. They have a road going across the Man Mount. Unfortunately, they built that before it was protected. But yeah, that's good.
Thank you, Paul, for filling us in on that. Kent had emailed, what's known about the Monticello nuclear plant and the waste that was dumped into the ground, which then apparently seeped into the Mississippi?
Yeah, that's deuterium, which is kind of heavy water. It's not real radioactive, but it is. And all of the nuclear plants leak some. There's radioactivity coming off of the whole industry. I mean, I could get into that. Monticello is a very old plant. It was not built to last as long as it's been operating. And that's true with a lot of them. Minnesota and Wisconsin both have moratoriums on building new nuclear plants, as far as I know. And a lot of them are on the river. In fact, if I can digress quickly, sure. I actually wrote a song about that back when I was singing. It was on All Things Considered once, and around the late 80s, they played it in its entirety. And it was about that. It was saying, everyone says, well, it's a little leak. And it was addressing all the nuclear plants on the river, and that by the time it gets to New Orleans, the river is glowing, which of course it's not, but it was just trying to get that concept across that, it's not a big danger, but I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about it now that there's proposals to build new nuclear plants that are supposed to be modular and safe. I'm a little skeptical, but that's not what we're here to discuss. I'll have to start singing that song again, maybe. We'll see.
Let's take another call. Treble in Lodi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I've got a question for your guest, and thank you for answering my call, Larry.
Sure.
Enjoy your show. My question is about the location of the final wiping out of the British band of foxes and Sauk Indians at the mouth of the Bad Axe River, which empties into the Mississippi River. And I finally found it on the map, my gazetteer. And it doesn't look like there's any kind of monument or anything for this battle that occurred when the United States Army and the various militias killed the remaining Indians, their wives, children, and grandparents at this site where they were trying to escape across the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I'm pretty familiar with that. There are some monuments on the highway there, and it's interesting because the monuments that are built at different times tell different stories. The best way to find out about it is there's an autobiography of Black Hawk, which I've read a number of times. They reached the river where Black Hawk Park is now, which is a park and campground operated by the Army Corps of Engineers, and there's a plaque there right on the shoreline by what they call Massacre Island out there, and it was a massacre, basically. It was mostly the militia, which were kind of undisciplined, and they were shooting everybody. They were shooting the women and children. In fact, at that point, there were a lot of elderly people and women. It was mostly elderly people and women and children that they had tracked down, and the band had tried to surrender several times, and when they did, they were fired upon, and they had worked their way across there. It's an interesting story. I don't have time to really get into it, but Most of them were probably massacred there. A few made it across the river, and the Dakota people from Winona, Minnesota, actually went down there and killed a lot of them that made it across the river because they were enemies. And a few of the warriors escaped up the Bad Axe River and were captured, including Black Hawk, who had led them. They were called the British Band because they took the British side in the War of 1812, and Black Hawk had done some pretty impressive strategic moves in battles. He was known as kind of a brilliant person in war, but he was pretty old when that whole thing started. It was basically because their land had been taken away.
Yeah. Treble, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We got time for another story or two. The one story that kind of interested me was people in Iowa, Minnesota, Arkansas, I think, and I forget, maybe one other state, might be surprised to know that the legal description of their property ties to a single rock in a swamp in Arkansas.
I got a kick out of that, and we usually try to confine our stories to the Driftless area and so on, but that story was just too good to pass up because that rock was used as the starting point for the surveys, all the way into the Dakotas and so on. I mean, it was a huge part of the Louisiana Purchase was surveyed from that rock.
They needed a point of reference.
Yeah, that was the point of reference for all those surveys in all those states west of the Mississippi. So the parts of Minnesota that are east of the Mississippi weren't part of the Louisiana Purchase. But, and so I couldn't pass. The other story I couldn't pass up, even though it was in Indiana, was a guy who rescued someone who fell through the ice, trying to rescue a dog that fell through the ice. He rescued the dog and the guy with his jump rope because this guy is a professional jump roper. And even though it was in Indiana, we have so much ice around here and people are falling through it, I thought it was appropriate. But it's just such a goofy story, I couldn't resist.
I don't blame you. Ellie emailed to say they live in Middleton, and Ellie and her spouse make a trip to the Effigy Mounds National Monument each year. Gorgeous area, great views of the river, lovely trails, awesome museum. They've learned a lot there, and it's a wonderful place to visit.
I agree totally. I love that place, and I go there pretty regularly. I've been there many, many times. Yeah.
So what are you going to do for your birthday besides being on this show?
Well, I kind of partied yesterday, and I have a board of directors meeting this afternoon. So I don't know. I think I offered to bring dinner home, and I think I'm going to be surprised when I come home. At least I hope so, because I was told not to. And I'll probably just have a little drink of scotch and watch a movie, kind of low-key, you know.
Yeah, well,
I mean, this was the high point. The singing was the high point, Larry.
Well, it's always a high point when you're on the show, Reggie. You know so much, and I always learn something, and I know our listeners do as well. And that latest issue, that March-April issue, it's going to be landing on people's doorsteps pretty darn quickly. How do people find out and maybe subscribe to Big River?
Well, our website is at bigrivermagazine.com, and we have an 800 number. You can call in at 1-800-303-8201.
Reggie, thanks. Yeah. Happy birthday, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Have a happy birthday, too.
Yeah. Mine's a ways away yet, May 14th. Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, our guest. Always fun. There's a lot of good information in this latest issue. Well, they're in all the issues. Coming up, our weather guys are going to talk weather and climate with you. That next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.